You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of September, 2013, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Phil Hahn, and Poppy Trowbridge.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Angela Merkel prepares to defend her premiership at the German elections next week. Is she ready? She says she's changed Germany for the better.
Es waren vier gute Jahre für Deutschland, weil es heute vielen Menschen in Deutschland besser geht, als es ihnen vor vier Jahren gegangen ist.
Angela Merkel there addressing the final session of Parliament in Berlin last week.
Also on the programme, James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press, joins us today in the studio to set the day's agenda. James, what do you have for us?
Nigeria's president has sacked nine of his ministers and not replaced them with anyone yet. America's most famous jihadi has reportedly been killed in Somalia. And a new report from UNICEF says that child mortality has fallen by half, but still not on track to meet the Millennium Development Goal.
Also on the program, filmmaker Biban Kidron will explore how the internet is changing young people's view of the world.
The point is that everything that glitters is not gold, which doesn't mean to say that the gold bit isn't glittery.
Plus, we'll check in with our man in Seoul and review this morning's US newspapers.
So lots to come in the next 60 minutes here on Midori House. We may even play some music as well. That's all to come in the next hour here on Monocle 24. So a very busy Friday edition of the programme here on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn and Poppy Trowbridge. But before all that, we have the news headlines from David Spencer.
Thank you, Monocle 24 News. I'm David Spencer. At least three people have been killed after insurgents attacked the US consulate in western Afghanistan's main city of Herat. They detonated a powerful truck bomb outside the front gates before a fierce gun battle with US and Afghan security forces. A spokesman for the US Embassy in Kabul said all US personnel in the consulate were safe and had been accounted for. The Taliban's claimed responsibility for the attack. Further talks are due to take place later between US Secretary of State John Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov on disarming Syria's chemical weapons programs. Thursday's one-hour meeting has been described as comprehensive, but differences remain. Also attending the discussions is United Nations Special Envoy to Syria, Lakhdar Brahimi.
I saw the secretary, he was very kind, and we spoke about Syria, about Geneva, and he's still committed to it, and we hope that once they have done what they have to do with the Russians on this chemical issue, we will start talking again about Geneva.
A fire at a Russian psychiatric hospital has killed at least one person, with dozens of patients missing. Officials say a member of staff died while trying to save patients at the hospital in the town of Luka in Novgorod region. At least 35 people are unaccounted for. It's the second deadly blaze at a psychiatric hospital in Russia this year and is likely to prompt criticism of the state over its treatment of the mentally ill and other vulnerable citizens. The sentencing is due to take place of four men found guilty of raping and murdering a student in the Indian capital Delhi in a case that caused violent protests across India about male attitudes to women. The four were found guilty on all counts against them on Tuesday. Prosecutors say they deserve the death penalty because of the brutality of the crime. Defence lawyers plan to appeal. The 23-year-old woman was attacked on a bus last December and died 2 weeks later. The case also led to new laws being introduced against rape. An external advisor hired by Tokyo Electric Power Company has played down worries over the latest in a series of leaks at the crippled Fukushima plant. TEPCO said last month that 300 tons of highly radioactive water leaked from one of the steel tanks, which was crippled by a massive earthquake and tsunami in March 2011. That leak followed an earlier statement by the company that hundreds of tons of contaminated water was flowing out from the plant into the ocean every day. But Lake Barrett, a former advisor to the US Nuclear Regulation Authority, says there are no major concerns.
The levels that are quote, moving are very small and very low risk. And, you know, water flows toward the sea. So where's the thing go? It goes toward the sea. But as far as any radioactivity of concern, in my opinion, is being adequately controlled.
Police in the Netherlands are set to be the first in the world to use rats to sniff out blood, drugs and explosives. The animals are due to go into active service next year, operating under the names Poirot, Magnum and Derek, TV detectives popular in the Netherlands, as well as Janssen and Janssen, the Dutch names for the bowler-hatted detectives in Tintin. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks, David. More from you in the bottom of the hour. It is 5 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House live from a Studio One here in London. The time is 6 minutes past the hour. It's time now, though, to set the day's news agenda. And joining us today in the studio is James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press. Welcome to the show, James. Happy Friday to you. Let's begin with the deaths of two militants related to the Al-Shabaab terrorist organization in Somalia. Rather an interesting story here.
So it's been reported that an American jihadi who goes by the name of Abu Mansur al-Amriki, so like basically his name is the American, who is from Alabama and was part of the militant Islamist group Al-Shabaab in Somalia. But he's basically fallen foul of the leadership, who said that he was being too self-promoting. And he was quite self-promoting. He's got a prominent Twitter handle. He's got YouTube videos. He does jihadi raps.
His nickname was The Rapper, wasn't
His nickname was The Rapper, yeah, the jihadi rapper. And in about December of last year, he became persona non grata for Al-Shabaab. And there have been, this is not the first time this year it's been reported he's killed. It's the second time. There was also an attempt on his life early on in the year, which he tweeted. He just said, "I've just been shot in the neck, but it's fine. I'm going to be okay." But the reports that he's been killed in a dawn raid yesterday are more credible than the previous one saying he's been killed, which had come more from government sources, whilst these come from Shabaab sources.
Did the publicity just get too much for them?
So it's two things. One, it's his publicity got pretty big and he got a kind of independent voice within the organization.
A bad thing, apparently.
A bad thing. But also the guy who's now in charge, the emir of Al-Shabaab, is a guy called Gadane, and he is brooking no dissent. So there's been there's lots of purges going on at the moment. He is killing off all potential rivals, other people who set up the organization. And Al-Amriki was a big critic of Gadane, which is why he fell foul. So it's, one, a story about an American jihadi with a YouTube channel, and we've got these interests, but also it demonstrates how Shabaab is fighting against amongst itself. It's kind of got an internal civil war going on.
And there's also rumors that a British national was also killed who's related to Al-Shabaab. But as you just mentioned, it kind of highlights this division between the foreign fighters within Al-Shabaab and then the native Somali fighters within Al-Shabaab. Do you think this internal conflict is perhaps good news, though? Of course, terror experts around the world saying this could potentially, they could potentially be destroying themselves from within.
Possibly, but depends which expert you talk to, because both things are being said. On the one hand, people are saying, "Well, Al-Shabaab is tearing itself apart. It's not going. You know, it's probably going to be less of a force, even though most regional governments in the UN still think it's the most important militant group in the country." But then people on the other side saying, "Well, this might lead to basically competitions for extreme extremism and extreme violence, and so it could go the other way."
James, take us on to your next story, a shakeup in the Nigerian cabinet.
So Nigeria's president, Goodluck Jonathan, is facing the biggest political challenge he's ever got. His party has effectively split in half, the ruling party, and pretty much over his leadership. And he's trying to fight back now. At the very end of last month, seven governors, powerful governors of states, quit his faction of the party and set up another one. And he's sacking ministers who are associated with his internal party enemies.
In a nutshell, what was he doing that they didn't like? Because they are on
wanting
the same side.
Sort of on the same side. But he wants to be president after 2015. There are new elections and he wants to run again. And they, a lot of his party, especially a lot of senior northern political figures, really don't want him to run again.
And talk to us a bit about the internal conflict that's also happening in Nigeria. Of course, the mainly Muslim north and then the Christian south, this kind of battle between these two sects within the country.
So you can kind of fit this into that, because it is more northern political leaders against Goodluck Jonathan, who's from the core south. But I think that's actually a bit simplistic, because one, it doesn't look at this is an elite struggle between Nigeria's got a kind of polycentric elite with overlapping alliances and friendships and lots of frenemies and that sort of thing, and it should be seen in that context. And also, it's not just simply a North v South thing. It's Goodluck Jonathan has also upset some of his former backers. So former President Olusegun Obasanjo, who basically put him in position, who is also a Christian, who's from the Southwest. He's Yoruba from the Southwest of the country. And he is fallen out as well. So this dynamic, although you can link it to the North-South, to the Muslim-Christian, it's not shouldn't primarily be viewed through
and
that.
Do you think he'll most likely lead the country after 2015?
He's probably just about odds on to hang on to his party's nomination, but it really depends, because if half his party go and join the opposition, which is recently united, which is possible, then really he's not left with very much support and not much else. But he's still president, he's still got access to a load of money, and he can pretty much pay people off.
He needs to replace those positions with people who will support him right through.
Exactly, which is what he's likely to do, is place his guys from each of the states in ministerial positions so they can act as his point men and help to undermine the governors who oppose him in their various states.
And finally, you have a report coming out from UNICEF on child mortality, both good and bad news in this rather in-depth report.
Yes.
Explain.
So the good news in this report on child mortality is that number of children under five dying has fallen by about 50% since 1990, which is the good headline news. And there's been really good progress in lots of parts of the world. Southern Africa, East Africa are really good. But the bad news is that it's at the current rates, they won't meet the Millennium Development Goals, which is to cut it by 2/3. And the goal is to do that by 2015.
What are the reasons for that?
Slow progress. It's slow progress in Western Central Africa. A lot of the countries that aren't doing well, or a lot of the deaths are clustered in a few countries, DRC, Nigeria, and so on. But then there are other sort of perhaps more critical reasons why it isn't working, because the MDGs tend to incentivize technical solutions and things that are measurable and things that you can wipe out easily and measure wiping out. And it's been argued that the final push requires a much more holistic approach that looks at more at mother's health as well, and looks at social status of women and all of these things coming together. And so it can be argued that to get the final hurdle, they need to pretty much stop counting and view things less technically and more holistically.
And we are seeing some substantial improvements, though, outside of Africa, some very good news in places like East Asia and the Pacific and Latin America as well. Why do you think those countries have managed to at least perhaps being able to reach those millennium goals by 2015, as opposed to the African countries unable to?
If you take, some have. So Ethiopia, for example, Ethiopia is a poor country, at least in a per capita basis. Generally, it's if countries have been getting a lot richer since the year 2000, then their levels of children dying young decrease. If you have more money, you tend to be able to have national healthcare programs and so on. But there, within that, you can see what programs have been working, which ones haven't. So Kenya is actually going slightly backwards, but it does have a national healthcare program of sorts, whilst Ethiopia is doing really well. It's meeting its goals with limited resources.
James, good to have you here with us today. James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press.
Coming up after this very short break, is the German election in the bag for Chancellor Angela Merkel?
Are you tired of overcooked and overrated culinary trends that never quite hit the spot? Fed up of being spoon-fed half-baked ideas on the next big thing? Then tune into The Menu with me, Markus Hippi. Every week we introduce you to the world's top makers and shakers, cocktail creators and the best bread makers as we uncover gourmet street food, big-time baristas and wily wineries.
Once upon a time, it was seen with disdain, but over the years, that culture had gotten so popular, it's iconic now.
If you're serving decent food in East London, don't you got any problem getting custom in? And I worked in the West End for years, you know. I mean, it's not always packed in the West End, trust me.
This is the show that discovers how coffee can change a country and how chocolate can make us live longer, all in the search for exciting local food producers and the most original entrepreneurs.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
The Review is Monocle 24's weekly review and preview of the arts. Every Saturday, we take a relaxed look back at the books, TV shows, films, music, theatre and events that have made our week, while looking around the corner to scout out the next big thing.
It doesn't feel sappy, it doesn't feel sentimental. It does have a certain heft.
It's very Darwinian. The shows that do well run and the ones that don't close. And there have been some quite high-profile flops and some great successes as well.
For me, it's riotous, it's tasteless, but it's actually dynamic as well. It has momentum.
Join Monocle's editors as they sit down with our favourite critics, opinion makers and key industry figures for some in-depth discussion and lively debate. And we provide inspiration for the weekend from cities around the world.
It's a real divider because I know some people just love this film and other people really just hate it.
That's A Review, every Saturday at midday London time and across the weekend, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. The time is 9:17 in Berlin. It is 8:17 here in London. Now, some good news. The Eurozone is out of recession, so Germany can finally go a bit easier on its crisis-struck neighbours and focus on its own issues. Well, national elections are taking place on the 22nd of this month, and Angela Merkel is looking for a third term in office.
Now, some credit her with standing firm on reforms that are vital to Europe's recovery. Her critics insist she's inflexible, and that's broken the back of other Eurozone economies, condemning millions to poverty. Her main challenger in the elections is calling for more solidarity with those very nations and, of course, less austerity. Well, joining us on the line now are Quintin Peel, Berlin bureau chief for the Financial Times, and Dr. James Sloan, co-director of the Centre for European Politics at Royal Holloway, that's at the University of London. You're both very welcome to the show. Good morning to both of you. Quintin, let me start with you here. Just a week to go, could you say that people are looking forward to the elections?
I think, to be absolutely honest, they're all a bit bored. There really haven't been any great moments of excitement, and all the debate seems to have been desperately inward-looking. There are lots of posters out and about on the streets, and there are lots of meetings that have been taking place. But one of the interesting things is a higher proportion of people seem to be undecided about how they're going to vote than in any previous election.
And Quintin, why is it that the opposition candidate, Peer Steinbrück, hasn't really been able to capitalize on any of Chancellor Merkel's weaknesses?
Well, one of the problems is that his policies are rather like hers, or put differently, every time he's come up with an interesting policy, she's stolen it. So she's very successfully occupied the middle ground of German politics, whereas he's been pushed further to the left than he feels comfortable with. So that's one problem. On the European question, though, in particular, the end game is that they're both in the same position. They both are prepared to put money into rescue funds for Greece or for whoever else might come up along the line, but they are also demanding pretty strict rules in exchange. And he can't show himself to be much more generous than Angela Merkel is, because that really wouldn't be popular with German voters.
So, Quentin, are Germans the type of people to go with the devil they know rather than the devil they don't?
Yes, I think so. I mean, there's what comes through in all the polls is there is no mood for change in Germany.
German.
And that's precisely what Angela Merkel represents. Safe pair of hands, somebody they know, somebody who's reassuring and is not threatening to have dramatic reforms.
Quentin, Berlin bureau chief there for the Financial Times, Quentin Peel, many thanks for joining us here on the program. We're going to turn now to Dr. James Sloan. He is co-director of the Centre for European Politics at Royal Holloway at the University of London. Many thanks for joining us here on the program, James. This election has really been framed all about Angela Merkel, the person, the candidate, the leader. We haven't really heard much about kind of grand visions for the future direction of Germany or new policies. It really has all been about her.
Yes, absolutely. I think, and barring a seismic shift over the next few days, we are talking about Angela Merkel plus again. She's not known as setting out a grand vision, but perhaps that's her political strength. But in terms of Germany, the country, it may actually be a weakness. I think one of the interesting things that you were talking about with Quentin was the issue of Europe and the financial crisis. Currently, Germany has this tough fiscal austerity policy that's played well at home, but not necessarily been to the great benefit of the European Union to countries like Greece, Spain, Portugal and Ireland, because if they're paying back all of these loans on short terms, then how are their economies going to grow? So the interesting question really is, it's Angela Merkel plus, but which coalition partner is she going to go with? Is she going to have enough support in the Bundestag to form another coalition with a small Liberal Party? Will it be another grand coalition with the Social Democrats, which we had in 2005 to 2009, or a new type of coalition with the German Green Party? And these subtle choices in coalition partner might mean something different for Germany's policy in Europe, which is the interesting point.
Absolutely. And, you know, many would argue that Angela Merkel has been the main stumbling block to closer integration within the European Union, specifically when we're talking about closer fiscal ties, a closer banking union. It has been Angela Merkel and the Germans really avoiding any real push for more integration.
Yeah, and I think so that's really where the coalition politics becomes important. We know, really, that Angela Merkel's going to be the next Chancellor, but if she forms a coalition with the Social Democrats, whilst I agree with Quentin that they have similar policies, they will have a big enough alliance and a big enough majority within Parliament perhaps to take unpopular decisions, which means maybe allowing an extension of the debt agreements with the debtor countries and maybe a more positive policy in European integration. The interesting question, though, is if she goes with the Greens, they're known as being the most pro-European of all the German parties. So you're more likely to see steps forward in European integration with an alliance with the Green. But the one note of caution here is the performance of this new Eurosceptic party, the Alternative for Deutschland, or Alternative for Germany, which is hovering about 3% at the moment. Now, it's unlikely to get past the 5% threshold that you need to enter the Bundestag, but if it does, then that could really mean a step back for Germany in terms of its integration plans in the European Union.
James, very briefly, she's known as being a very frank person. She loves to tell you about all the hardships that you face. What's her message to her potential voters about what lies ahead for them?
I think her message is one of trust. As Quentin said, she's a safe pair of hands. She's saying, if you vote for me, you can trust me. I've sorted out the economy. We've got through the financial crisis. We've got through this Eurozone crisis. If you trust in me, and which most German people do, then I'll see you through the next few years, and Germany will continue to grow and prosper within Europe and the larger world.
James, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there, but many thanks for joining us here on the program. Dr. James Sloan, co-director of the Centre for European Politics at Royal Holloway at the University of London. And before that, we were speaking to Quentin Peel, Berlin bureau chief for the Financial Times. Now, next, we're going to be heading to the good old US of A in search of a good cheese. Now, in the high desert of far west Texas, some 320 kilometers from the nearest airport, you can find fresh artisan goat's cheese in grocery stores and on restaurant menus. Well, Marfa Made, a small dairy in Marfa, has been bringing inventive cheeses to rural Texas.
Until the dairy opened 3 years ago, there was little opportunity for goat's cheese in this dusty part of America. Well, now, this little boutique dairy has made its mark on the community, with people driving for miles to sample their products. Megan Dietry headed down there for this week's edition of The Menu to find out how Marfa Made is doing in such a remote location, and of course, what makes a good goat's cheese.
To get to Marfa Made Dairy, you drive a couple of miles outside of town down a dirt road. The land is covered in cactuses and tall yellow grass. Gently sloping mountains dot the skyline. The dairy is small, only around 30 goats, but its owners, Melinda Beeman and Alan McLean, are passionate about cheesemaking in the desert. I met Melinda in the dairy's kitchen just as she was about to begin making Marfa Made's green herb chev spread.
I approach the cheesemaking like making a piece of art. You know, it's not just something that's accomplished and then you do it and you get it over with. It's really something that the concept, the quality of it and the beauty of it has to be sustained.
Melinda spent decades as a printmaker and says she's brought the process-oriented nature of her art to cheesemaking. She preps the herbs, picked fresh from her garden this morning.
Today, what we have is basil, chives, tarragon, thyme, oregano, and marjoram. When we make our chev, people ask me if I put lemon in it, and I say no, but it has a sort of a piquant edge to it. And a lot of people say, oh, they can't stand goat's milk or goat cheese because it smells or tastes goaty. The milk wasn't used freshly enough.
She mixes the herbs, garlic, oil, salt, and chèvre into a food processor.
And I don't measure anything, obviously, but I do feel like I keep the flavors pretty consistent, and I use kosher salt. And it's in a food processor.
The cheese sits for a day, developing a deeper flavor.
I think your cheese is so good, it's not due to the normal things like beautiful, you know, fields of green grasses and purebred animals. But I think it's due to the fact that Alan gives them an enormous amount of love and attention.
Melinda's husband, Alan, handles the milking and is pretty smitten with his herd. Each goat has a name, and Alan, well, Alan plays favorites.
Eddie's personal favorite. But she's been kind of acting out lately, so usually that's an indication something's up there.
My goats all have distinct personalities. Some people would say I'm crazy, but, you know, that's the way I perceive it.
These goats are pampered. They're given minerals, molasses, and protein-rich alfalfa every day. After milking, I follow Alan outside to feed the goats.
No lucky. Oh. Brownie is Nubian. Una, with the one horn, she is a combination of Alpine and Nubian.
Alpine and Nubian breeds are both considered good for milking, but for different reasons.
One has a higher butterfat content, one gives more milk. So it's trying to get the combination of I can maintain a little higher butterfat content yet get bulk on my milk. I mean, I think the thing about our product is it's fresh.
If you want to try Marfa Made cheese, you'll have to travel to West Texas. But you can find Melinda every Saturday at Farm Stand in Marfa, a weekly farmer's market she helped found 6 years ago.
Well, today I have green chili, basil, garlic, and fresh herb.
I'll take a green chili.
Okay, and that's $6.
This is absolute goat cheese.
Farm Stand has become a weekly gathering place for Marfa residents. All aspects of the community, from generations-old ranchers to the town's young artists to the Latino population, everyone comes to buy honey, vegetables, and empanadas.
The Farm Stand, I think, is absolutely wonderful. I go down for the gossip, and I also go down for the honey.
For Marfa Made, the farmer's market has developed a dedicated following.
I mean, I let down one of my best clients this week because I forgot to bring plain Chev, and she drives 60 miles.
For the West Texas area, Marfa-made goat cheese is a huge part of the community. It's a little bit of inventive flavor made close to home. For Monocle and Marfa, I'm Megan Dietry.
And you can hear more from the brand new edition of The Menu this evening at 1900 hours London time. That's also 1400 hours if you happen to be in Toronto snacking on a little bit of good old Canadian cheese, which I'm a big fan of. Love cheese.
We know you are, Phil. Cheese is your middle name, I think they say.
Ouch.
Well, in the next half hour of the program, we'll get the latest news from our man in Seoul and review the U.S. front pages. Also, filmmaker Biban Kidron will explore how the internet is changing young people's view of the world.
The point is that everything that glitters is not gold, which doesn't mean to say that the gold bit isn't glittery.
But first, let's get the latest world news headlines with David Spencer.
Thank you. The Taliban says it was behind an attack on the U.S. consulate in western Afghanistan's main city of Herat. They detonated a powerful truck bomb outside the front gates before a fierce gun battle with U.S. and Afghan security forces. Further talks are due to take place later between U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov on disarming Syria's chemical weapons programs. Officials said Thursday's one-hour meeting was comprehensive, but that differences remain. A fire at a Russian psychiatric hospital has killed at least one person, with dozens of patients missing. Officials say a member of staff has died while trying to save patients at the hospital in the town of Luka in Novgorod region. Four men are due to be sentenced in Delhi for the rape and murder of a student last December in a case that caused violent protests across India. Prosecutors say they deserve the death penalty because of the brutality of the crime. Defence lawyers plan to appeal. An external advisor hired by the owner of Japan's Fukushima plant has played down worries over the latest in a series of leaks at the site. Lake Barrett, a former advisor to the US Nuclear Regulation Authority, says there are no major concerns despite revelations about water contamination. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
David, I thought you were going to mention the story about the Dutch rats being used to sniff out drugs and explosives. I had the perfect pun with that goat's cheese item.
Oh, no. Yeah. I'm sorry to disappoint you.
Phil, I think
you.
He saw it coming. Yeah.
Spencer. you're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn and Poppy Trowbridge. The time is 9:32 in Madrid. It's 8:32 here in London. Now we're sitting here in Studio One at Midori House, our smartphones next to us and our laptops in front, all the while constantly connected to the internet. It's a prospect that for many of us, we wouldn't be able to live without, being online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
But a new film by director Biban Kidron aims to highlight our overdependence on the internet and how it perhaps most worryingly is changing younger generations' view on life. In Real Life is the title of the film. And a little earlier, Phil spoke to its director, Biban Kidron. He began by asking her whether children have been outsourced to the internet.
I think the reason that I had that question was that I kept on seeing kids with their iPhones with the computer and so on. And I realized that there was a sort of an interruption between our generation and the next. And, you know, it's very fashionable to call them the digital natives and us the immigrants and so on and so on. But I think that it doesn't really help us understand whether it's a problem or not. And I didn't start from the perspective of this is a problem. What I started from was the idea that it might be worth us looking to see what they were engaging with, who they were engaging with, and whether we were somehow dropping our personal responsibility in not knowing a bit more about the world in which they live.
And the film follows several case studies, several individuals around the world when it comes to their relationship with the internet. It's not kind of a traditional one-person narrative. And you follow everyone, you know, from people that are addicted to so-called cyber porn, people that are addicted to online dating. Let's just have a quick listen, though, from a group of teenagers when it comes to perhaps their relationship with pornography and how that's affected their relationship in real life. Let's have a listen.
Big tits.
team and sort of try out a girl and get a perfect image of what you've watched on the internet. I find now that it's so hard for me to actually feel the connection for a girl.
So a group of teenagers, they're really giving us a sense of how the internet has shaped when it comes to their personal relationships. How much has stuff really changed and impacted, you know, this generation of people?
I think that one of the things that is really curious is that more and more teenagers are learning about sex from pornography. And I think you got to look at that in two ways. One is you go, where would I like my child to learn about sex from? Well, pornography, no. Because the thing about pornography is that it's a very particular gaze. It is designed to be transgressive. 80% of it has violence in it. And it's very gendered. And so it's a problem for the boys because they're sort of living up to some very macho sexuality that a lot of them are uncomfortable with. And then it's a huge problem for the girls. And we don't hear enough about girls and the outcome of pornography.
Well, how much do you think is it fair to blame the internet or say it is because of the internet? Because obviously there are a whole host of other factors from movies to, you know, to television shows to music.
Well, I think that, you know, what's really interesting and what's one of the big debates for us all about the internet is, you know, that actually in television shows and in other arenas, even music, there is regulation about what you can and can't do. The problem about the internet is that it's ubiquitous, is it's everywhere, it's all the time, and this stuff is freely available without any contextualization. So I think you're right in raising the question. We can't blame the internet. The internet's a brilliant and marvelous invention. And the internet is something that is our future. It is our society. It's not a technical thing. It's not a technological thing. It's about how we use the internet, what values the internet providers have, what values and what we have as parents and what we want to insist upon for our children. So it's much more around how we use it than the technology itself.
And apart from these individual stories which you bring to our attention, you really raise some more broader issues, questions about our privacy and our security. And of course, this comes at a very salient time with the Edward Snowden and NSA scandal really engulfing most of the world. People don't really think of that infrastructure, that system of what kind of lies behind the screen, do they? They really have no concept of actually what is happening. And you raise, perhaps you give us an insight into some of the more scary aspects of how we are living our lives.
Well, yeah, I thought that was really important. And I have to, you know, I myself had no idea that the internet was a bunch of tubes. I thought it was something up in the sky, a satellite all around us. And I realized as I was going through making the film and getting this witness from these kids that actually neither our generation nor theirs has a clue about what it is and who owns it. And I thought that that was a very important point because, as you say, we have discovered recently what governments do. But at least nominally, if we don't like what governments do, we can vote them out of office. The people who own the big bulky bits of the internet, we have no control over whatsoever. And I just felt by understanding, by having a sort of a visceral experience of the internet itself, of seeing that it's made up of these parts and pieces, that people were perhaps think a little bit more about how they used it, about how they threw themselves upon its mercy. And maybe as a community, we should look a little bit more about whether it is acceptable that it's almost impossible to do anything without using the internet. And therefore, I think we have a responsibility to make sure that we understand how it works and who's in charge.
Well, finally, let's kind of look forward to perhaps the next generation. In your film, you really focus on kids kind of from, what, 12 to 18, 19 years old. So they necessarily didn't have iPads or iPhones when they were growing up. But look at a typical toddler now, and you'll see them, you know, next to you sitting on an airplane, playing with an iPad, playing games, and they're just 3 years old. So if this is the picture that you're painting of a generation that didn't have that kind of technology when they were toddlers, look to us in the future. What kind of picture do you think we'll be painting when these kids that are three now are 13 or 23?
Well, I think it's a brilliant question because the truth of the matter is there's a huge upsurge in playground accidents right now in the States. And when they went, why is it suddenly with all our health and safety that the kids are falling off the jungle gym? Guess what? It's because the people caring for them are all on the phone and not watching. There's research coming out that kids go into nursery and they don't know how to look at each other because they're so used to engaging with people via a screen that they haven't had the early learning about voice and face and expression. There is a lot of research happening that says that kids can't concentrate one line at a time. And Sherry Turkle, who is, you know, a great internet observer, says that she thinks in the future that employers are going to have to teach unitasking. They're going to have to teach people coming into the workplace how to do one thing at once, because human beings are not designed to multitask. In fact, you can't. You can only do several things badly or superficially. And so she says this is kind of the new world order. I think, you know, I don't want to paint a horrendous future. What you have to remember is the internet is this huge revolution. It's huger than all of us, that actually many creative and brilliant things are going on the internet. The point is that everything that glitters is not gold, which doesn't mean to say that the gold bit isn't glittery. And it's very convenient to make people like me the sort of the naysayers and have the utopians over here. In fact, I've spoken to many, many, many world experts, and everybody's a bit worried at the center. And the problem is that all of this space has become monetized. All of it has become commercial. All of the power is on one side. And I think consumers need to rebel a bit now.
Phil Hahn speaking to filmmaker Biban Kidron. Really interesting. We don't question this concept of too much of a good thing that often, do we?
Lots of really interesting themes from that film, of course. It's called In Real Life. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with a look at whether relations are starting to finally thaw between the two Koreas.
Join us at midday London time every weekday for The Briefing, Monocle 24's fast-paced, hour-long roundup of global breaking news stories, in-studio analysis, and a first look at the North American front pages. And for those waking up on the East Coast, it's the perfect way to get a Monocle take on the stories you need to know at the start of each day. The Briefing, live at midday London time, 7 a.m. in New York and 6 a.m. in Chicago.
You're listening to Midori House. The time is 8:42 here in London. That means 16:42 in Seoul, where we head now to speak to our man there, Jason Strother. Jason, welcome to the show.
Nice to be with you.
Thanks. You've got a couple of good stories for us today, but we're looking ahead, first of all, to Monday and the reopening of the industrial park. What's brought us here?
All right. Well, a lot of overnight negotiations. It was just earlier this week on Wednesday that after an overnight session, that envoys from both Koreas decided to finally reopen the Kaesong Joint Industrial Complex. It was closed down back in April when the peninsula seemed at the brink of war pretty much any day. It was an unprecedented move for North Korea to close it down for that long. So on Monday, the South Korean factory owners, managers will cross the DMZ and head back to Kaesong, where about 50,000 North Korean workers are employed at these 120 or so factories there. So far, the Unification Ministry here in Seoul says it's just a trial run, but the next step after it officially gets back up and running is to try to draw international investors to open up shop there.
And of course, Jason, the Kaesong Industrial Complex is much more important financially and economically to the North Koreans than it is to the South Koreans. But I'm wondering what this move to reopen the park really means, because we are now hearing reports that satellite imagery is showing that one of North Korea's nuclear reactors is potentially restarting. What impact could this have on relations between the two?
Sure, Phil. Well, yes, this, I would say, is another example of North Korea's two-pronged approach to international diplomacy. Throughout the past decade, really, it's played South Korea against the United States by opening the industrial park and also the two Koreas are poised to hold family reunions in the upcoming weeks for families that were separated during the Korean War 60 years ago. So it's making good with Seoul right now, but by restarting the reactor at the Yongbyon nuclear facility, as some analysts are suggesting, of course, that's going to, you know, raise the ire of Washington and ultimately Seoul too, as well as China and Japan. So this is, you know, on one, this is, North Korea has done this many times where they're offering these carrots, reopening the factory, holding family reunions, but meanwhile making progress on restarting, bolstering its nuclear weapons program.
Jason, is that just their modus operandi, give with one hand, take with another?
Yeah, pretty much. That's what they've always done. They've always tried, you know, and especially in terms of the Seoul-Washington alliance, they've always tried to play one off against the other. Usually with South Korea, it's an emotional appeal, such as the family reunions. But with Washington, Pyongyang is aware that the only way to really get the U.S. interested in what's going on the Korean Peninsula is to make it seem like their nuclear weapons program is back up and running, that, you know, they could potentially make, you know, dozens of more bombs if in fact they are producing processing plutonium again.
Take us on to this other story that you say is quite a big deal there. The idea that passports will be revoked for those that work in the sex trade in Korea. What's prompted this suddenly?
Right, Poppy. Well, this is kind of a badge of shame for South Korea. Many South Korean women go overseas to work as prostitutes. Figures that came out from the South Korean government about a year ago said 100,000 women go overseas, mostly to Japan, but also there are many who work in the United States and Australia. So now women found to have been working in prostitution will have their passports revoked for 3 years, and also Johns or other men who work and buy prostitutes or participate in the sex trade, they're going to be banned too from going overseas.
Is this a way to clean things up? Is that the idea?
Exactly. Well, yeah, I think South Korea is taking a lot of flack from other countries, Japan and some Southeast Asian countries in particular, about South Korean men going there. And I was just in the Philippines, and there's a lot of anger at South Koreans. Men go down there, they have many illegitimate children with Filipino prostitutes, and they abandon the children. So it's coming back to hit Seoul, and I think this is kind of a image maintenance, damage control that the South Korean government is doing to prevent these kind of situations, this kind of, you know, immoral image from, you know, getting any worse.
Jason, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. I'm going to stand up for the reputation of, as a fellow Korean myself, we're not all that bad. A couple of bad eggs there, but there are in every bunch. Jason Strother in Seoul. It is 8:47 in London, 9:47 in Frankfurt, which is where we're going to head to now, because Monocle's news editor Tom Edwards is at the Frankfurt Motor Show. Good morning to you, Tom. How are you?
Good morning, Phil. I am very, very well today. I'm just enjoying you're talking about a bunch of eggs. Very interesting.
Well, you're there at the motor show. Of course, you've got a special edition of the briefing, which is going to be broadcast at midday London time. What can we expect in that very special show?
Phil, it is going to be special. Of course, 1300 local time. I mean, I just thought I should really paint you a picture of the show. It's quite unbelievable if you've not visited before. Frankfurt's huge Messe complex. There's 11 halls. You can walk for miles and miles. It's a good workout. All the major sort of global players are here. They're kind of flexing their economic muscle and showing a bit of creative and engineering brilliance as well. So on the show, we'll be reflecting not just the big players in the industry and what they're up to, but also trying to capture a bit of the fun that happens here in Frankfurt as well.
Tom, who dominates at a show like this?
Well, naturally, Poppy, you know, the key players in the German industry have the most impressive. I mean, you can't even really call them stands. They're beyond that. They're so enormous. The whole hall's dominated by the likes of Mercedes, BMW, Audi, of course. And they do tend to sort of set the agenda, set the tone, and they do have the most arresting and captivating displays. Having said that, it is clearly still a massive event internationally. The eyes of the entire automotive world are fixed effect on Frankfurt during the couple of weeks that this happens. And I think what's definitely interesting is that rather than just the key developments from certain players, big industry-wide trends are very much the order of the day. I think particularly like electric and hybrid technology, e-mobility projects, that's very much the focus here this year.
And Tom, can you give us a sense of perhaps who you'll be speaking to on this afternoon's program?
Of course I can, Phil. We're going to be talking, amongst others, to the head of the German Automotive Industry Association. He's going to be putting us in the big picture, if you will, but we'll also be catching up with some of the leading designers from the likes of BMW, talking about autonomous driving as well, with Mercedes-Benz. Would you feel comfortable with that, Phil, letting your car drive you around?
I think so.
I read a great story about it. We've seen the Google Drive and all these apps, and I read a line in the paper the other day, Tom, that the ultimate goal would be to have your car drive you around automatically so that the driver could watch TV. Can you imagine that?
Doesn't that sound wonderful? I, for one, am ready to welcome our
robot
automotive overlords.
I'd snooze. I wouldn't watch TV.
Well, the good thing is you could go out for a dinner, you know, have a couple of bottles of wine, have your car drive you home.
I hadn't thought of that, Phil.
Having your own little personal chauffeur, you'd be passed out in the back seat. Perfect.
Doesn't that just sound ideal? But it is incredible, the technological advances that have happened just in this most recent generation, not just in terms of engineering, but in terms of how cars engage with one another on the road and with pedestrians as well. In the future, it's going to be more or less impossible, I think, to run over anybody, because the car's going to know your mistakes before you make them.
And Tom, are there any cars particularly you're looking forward to seeing? Are you going to head over to the Renault Clio stand, perhaps? Or are you more of a kind of a smart car kind of guy?
Well, Phil, I tend to like the big automotive traditions. And one thing that got me very excited this year is the Audi Quattro, one of the sort of seminal cars from the 1980s, rewrote the whole sort of books of what's possible in terms of automotive engineering. And Audi are showing a concept Quattro for the future. It's resplendent in a sort of yellowy gold color, amazing technology. And that's probably the one that's really caught my eye this year.
Tom, thanks so much. Monocle's news editor, Tom Edwards, at the Frankfurt Motor Show.
And of course, don't forget, you can tune into the briefing. That will be at 1300 hours in Frankfurt, 1200 if you're here listening in London, or 7 o'clock in the morning in New York. And they'll be coming live from the motor, the showroom floor of the Frankfurt Motor Show.
Welcome back. You are listening to Midori House with me, Poppy Trowbridge, and Phil Hahn. Time now to review the US front pages, and we're joined in the studio by Monocle producer Danny Giacopelli. Well, what have you got for us this morning? Good morning.
Good morning.
Are you a fan of cars?
It's Friday the 13th.
Follow cars or cheese?
I used to own a car. I still do eat cheese.
Okay.
Is that as far as it goes, Danny?
That's the extent of my my cheese and car fascination.
So you're not going to be that, glued to the screen of what's happening at the front.
I have been to the Javits Center in New York, the International Motor Show, I think it's called, which is just insane. I mean, I don't know how much bigger that is or how smaller it is.
Even if you're not
but it's gigantic.
Or an engineering fan, it's absolutely visually stunning, these kinds of shows.
It's just amazing to see the future trends, I think, of what we could potentially be, driving around in a couple of years. I think that's fascinating.
Yeah, and all the automakers bring out their biggest concept cars and kind of crazy new gadgets. It's fun.
Well, you've got some of the North American papers with you this morning. Shall we begin with the Washington Post?
Yeah, so as you might have read, Vladimir Putin did an op-ed in the New York Times the other day. There's no new Putin op-ed, but Dana Milbank from the Washington Post wrote a response to that, the American people's reply to Putin. And it's fairly sarcastic. It's I guess it's funny at times. It's a bit cringeworthy other times. Plays to the old, in Soviet Russia stereotypes that a lot of Americans like to bring out. But he makes fun of Putin's kind of Putin basically tried to get in with Americans by saying, I'm a God-fearing man like you. And Milbank takes him to task for this line that he had. It's extremely dangerous to encourage people to see themselves as exceptional.
But do you think that's helpful, Danny, to reply in that kind of slightly mocking tone?
I mean, he was doing it as a kind of I mean, Putin's op-ed was fairly ridiculous. Mm. Let's put it bluntly.
Well,
I mean,
many people in the U.S. did say it was, you know, he did come across as making his point quite eloquently, and a lot of people really praised, you know, he kind of had both arguments.
But they also made the point he could only do that in a place like America because he's put rules in place in his own country that don't allow equivalent freedoms of expression.
Yeah, I mean, he knew that Americans themselves are very wary of this oncoming, or whatever you want to call it, intervention. So he's playing up to that very, I mean, everything you read about what's going on right now with Russia and foreign policy, this is Russia's biggest foreign policy coup in, you know, I don't know how many decades. I mean, Putin really played this well, like Machiavelli or something. You know, he seized weaknesses that he saw in Obama and he took advantage, and now look where we are. I mean,
and another person perhaps taking advantage of the situation is Syria's president, Bashar al-Assad.
Sure, yeah. He's been kind of cleverly playing to international media. So he was kind of... you didn't see him in the media at all for, I mean, the past, I don't know how many years, 2 years during the crisis. He popped out every once in a while. But now, lo and behold, here he is kind of everywhere. He did Charlie Rose, now he's on Russian TV yesterday. And he said, well, sure, I'll agree to this Russia-U.S. proposal, but the U.S. has to stop arming the opposition and stop threatening Syria. Good luck with that. I mean, that's not going to happen. So we'll see. But yeah, he's shown his face a lot more now. And he's also taking advantage of this peculiar situation that they're in right now.
Do you think what he's doing when he sort of does these media blitzes is really getting his message across? Or do you think because he does them so infrequently that people don't pay much attention?
I'm not really sure if he cares who sees him and who doesn't. I mean, this is a guy who quite obviously and in the open gassed his own people, knowing that people would think he did it. I'm not entirely sure he cares about how the world sees him. I think he's trying to do what he's doing for the diplomats and the people who are running the foreign policies to kind of not bomb his country.
And Danny, let's move on to a story from your hometown, well, close, nearabouts, I guess, the race to become the next mayor of New York.
Yeah, so there was the primary election, and Christine Quinn, obviously a female. She would have been the first female mayor of New York City. She's out. She finished third. She went back to her job. and she's saying, well, there'll be a female mayor at some point soon. She's confident. And there probably will be.
She led the race for a while, though. Do we know why she fell so...
Well, no, I mean, not really. There's so many front runners in this race. You know, Anthony Weiner was a front runner at one point. I mean, in American political races, I mean, they go up and down. I mean, God, Donald Trump was a frontrunner for president one time. And
so she should have stuck around then. She could have gone back up again.
Yeah, who knows? But she may. So right now, Bill Thompson is holding out. And Bill de Blasio is looking like he's going to be the nominee.
And Danny, a fantastic story, which I really like here. And it involves the first, perhaps, a signal that we may have left our solar system.
Yeah, it's pretty astounding. I mean, Voyager 1, which left Earth 1977 on a four-year mission to Saturn. It was only meant to last 4 years to Saturn. Lo and behold, 36 years later, it's still sending signals back to Earth. It takes 17 minutes for the signals to reach Earth. And it's just left the solar system. It's the farthest, obviously, any human-made thing has left the solar system. They said it's 11.7 billion miles away, the equivalent to 125 trips from the Earth to the sun. I mean, this thing has one 240,000th the memory of an iPhone.
That's amazing.
And it's still, it's on an eight, it's an eight track, and it's still sending signals back.
12 billion miles
away. I mean, scientists
away.
Are just, you know, they say this is equivalent to, in their minds, going to the moon. I mean, having a piece of human hardware, you know, in the cold intergalactic space.
Who knows where it will end up? Danny Giacopelli with the U.S. newspapers. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Sadly, that's all we have time for today. Thanks to our producer, Barbara Feeney, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Elias Samos, our studio manager, Sam Impey.
Up next, after the news, is our design program, Section D, with Tom Morris, Guy Deloney, and Georgina Godwin. We'll be back with Midori House at the same time on Monday morning. But for me, Phil Hahn.
And me, Poppy Trowbridge.
Have a great weekend, and we'll see you back on Monday. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
A a Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.